Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now Michael Pollan on Food in America, from your Congress to your kitchen. And the legendary author will take your calls today on the biggest difference between your mother's kitchen and your own, the biggest difference between your mother's cooking and your own, the legendary and generally awesome food writer, Michael Pollan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Good to be back.
And the occasion, the excuse, is that Michael Pollan's latest book got released in paperback. That's the one called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. And many of you also know him from his earlier works, such as The Botany of Desire, The Omnivore's Dilemma, and In Defense of Food, among others. And we'll take your calls for Michael Pollan today on two tracks. First, anything you always wanted to chat up Michael Pollan about while making dinner, but he didn't happen to be around. 212-433-WNYC, your Michael Pollan sampler. 212-433-9692. And how about what I mentioned at the top as a conversation starter? What's the difference between your mother's cooking and your own? What's the biggest difference between your mother's kitchen and your own? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Or anything you always wanted to chat up Michael Pollan about, but he wasn't in your kitchen. 212-433-9692, and we'll take a lot of calls. Michael, I was looking at your bibliography, and I didn't realize that your first book back in 1991, if I read this right, was called Second Nature, A Gardener's Education.
Mm-hmm.
So was gardening your path into this big picture take on food in the modern world that's your main claim to fame?
Yeah. It actually, all my writing begins with my experience in the garden and trying to figure out how to grow. I always grew vegetables, trying how to contend with pests, woodchucks, and my relationship to these other species. And I got very engaged by the human relationship to the natural world. And if you care about that, you're going to get to food eventually, because we change the world more through our eating than anything else we do, more than the kind of car we drive, how we heat our home. It's really agriculture that changes the landscape, the composition of species, the atmosphere. And so that's kind of how I got into food, via the land.
Were you growing food or geraniums or what?
Mostly food. I mean, I was, you know, your typical guy gardener who wanted something to show for his efforts. And so I grew, you know, tomatoes and broccoli and kale and cabbage and that kind of stuff. But I had some flowers as well. I had a perennial border, too.
You grew up on Long Island, right?
I did. And I had my first garden when I was like 8 years old, along the foundation of our – we had a tract house in on the North Shore of Long Island. But I didn't call it a garden. I called it a farm. I had ambitions of going into business. So anytime I could get four strawberries, I'd put them in a Dixie cup and sell them to my mother.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Did your parents garden?
My dad was he was a great indoorsman.
Indoorsman.
Yeah, and he still is. He had no interest. His gardening consisted of trying to adjust the automated sprinkler system from the garage. That's as close to gardening as he got. But I had a grandfather, my mother's father, Max Stoller, who was a wonderful gardener, and he had a big garden in Babylon. And I loved hanging out in his garden, and I think I got my inspiration from him.
It's funny you say guy gardening. You want to produce stuff. I guess I was a guy gardener because I grew up in Queens in an apartment and then in a house that I guess you'd call a tract house by your definition there. And it had a little lawn and some shrubs, but it was the city. And for some reason, when I got my own place in Albany after college, I thought it would be great fun, of all the things I could do with my free time, to rent out a little farm plot with my two roommates, who were from the Bronx, by the way, who had even less nature than I did as a kid, at this place we heard about just outside the city limits that would rent a 10 by 30 plot. And we grew all kinds of vegetables and just enough flowers to try not to use any chemicals on the vegetables, mm-hmm. if they were the right match of flowers.
Right.
And we didn't know what we were doing at all, and we grew way too many broccoli and string bean plants. We had no idea. But the experience of getting into that dirt with our hands was so satisfying, and eating what we grew. I don't think I've ever looked at food the same way since. But I was definitely, I guess, your definition of a guy gardener, because I could tell people exactly how many tomatoes.
Yield, yeah.
And string beans and how many I put away in canning and freezing.
It's incredibly gratifying to grow your own food, even a little bit of it, and to realize, oh, yeah, this is where it comes from. And that engagement with those species in the land is, it's still one of my great satisfactions in life.
But then one of the things that caught people by surprise about your book, Cooked, when it first came out, is that you, who had already gotten famous for writing so deeply about food and about gardening, were writing about yourself as a novice in the kitchen.
Yeah.
So were you really a novice in the kitchen, more than three books deep into your food writing career?
Yeah, I was, actually. I mean, because as we just discussed, I came at it not from the food side I've been eating since I was quite young, but from the agriculture side. Gardening got me into studying agriculture, which produced Omnivore's Dilemma and figuring out where food comes from. And I hadn't paid that much attention. I cooked, but kind of indifferently, simply. I grilled things and made pasta. And I was fortunate enough to grow up in a household where we had family dinner every night. My mother's a wonderful cook, and she put dinner on the table four nights a week at least. But I hadn't given it much thought. And the reason I decided I wanted to give it more thought was that it dawned on me at a certain point that what I was observing that was wrong with American agriculture, which was essentially this move toward giant monocultures, whether they're corn and soy or animals and feedlots, that landscape had been created by people not willing to cook. And that we were complicit in that landscape, because if we're going to outsource our food preparation to McDonald's and General Mills and all these companies, they are only going to support the biggest, most monocultured farms because they want uniformity and they want cheapness. And so that if we were going to deal with that problem and make agriculture more diversified, more sustainable, it really depended on us taking more responsibility for our diets. And then on the health side, when I did In Defense of Food and learned all about nutrition and the dubious science of nutrition, because it turns out they actually know a lot less than you would think, I realized that the healthiest diets were not a matter of eating good nutrients or bad, but it was really a matter of was your meal cooked by a human being or a corporation? And if it was cooked by a human being, no matter what it was going to be substantially healthier. Because you talked about the difference between how your mom cooks and how you cook. There's a bigger difference, obviously, between how either of you cook and how a corporation cooks. They have a very distinctive style that involves tons of salt, fat, and sugar, the cheapest possible raw ingredients, no fiber that always gets processed out of food, and we're learning that's critical to our health, the health of our microbiome. And they also take all the water out of food when they process it. So there are more bites per calorie in processed foods. So I realized I had to deal with cooking because it really held the solution to dealing with agriculture on the one end and dealing with this public health crisis on the other.
Samira in Bogota, you're on WNYC with Michael Pollan. Hi, Samira.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thanks.
I just wanted to say to Michael Pollan, your books have changed drastically how I've eaten. And one of the first books I've read was In Defense of Food, which I thoroughly enjoyed. And I had a question for you, and I often think about your writing when I'm in the kitchen. I love to cook, but I'm never fresh on ideas. So I'm trying to get an early start on dinner today, and I was wondering what your favorite dinner dish was, and if you could kind of give me a quick recipe.
Oh, man.
Oh, man. And this, of course, is the book, right? You've
yeah.
got four recipes that you focus on in the book to get to larger points
right.
around the themes of earth, air, fire, and water, the four elements.
Yes.
But each one kind of represents a recipe.
Right.
So do you want to pick one of those for Samira that she could maybe do tonight?
Or she could go to my website where I've listed a lot of quicker recipes because you probably haven't done a lot of preparation or shopping that would involve like going out and buying some chicken or something like that and doing it quickly. Or if you want to get ambitious, I would go out and buy a pork shoulder. Do you have a grill?
Do you have a grill, Samira?
Yeah.
Okay. This isn't really for tonight. This is for tomorrow because one of the things I learned
I'm sorry, just to interrupt you. We don't actually eat pork.
Oh, okay.
We don't eat pork and we don't eat wine in our food.
Okay, so. You don't eat pork and you don't eat wine. Well, there's a wonderful recipe on the website for a vinegar chicken dish. Vinegar's okay, right? And it's a wonderful simple recipe that you can make in about 40 minutes. And you basically go buy a cut up chicken. And I'm sure you've got some vinegar in your pantry and some garlic. And I think that that would be a good way to go. It's a fairly quick braise. Braise is cooking slowly in liquid. This one's a little bit faster. And in about 40, 45 minutes, you can have a delicious meal. Serve it over a little rice. And I would go to the market right now and get – there's a very good asparagus around. And have it with asparagus. The easiest way to make vegetables, put them on a cookie sheet, toss them with a little olive oil and some salt, and put them in the oven for like 10 minutes, and you're good to go.
All right. Samira, I think you got what you asked for. Good luck with it. Let us know how it turns out. Nan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. You want to answer that question about your mother's kitchen compared to yours?
Yes, I do, although with due respect to my mom, who I adore, and she may well be listening to this, so I want to be careful. But we grew up in the 60s and 70s in New York City, and basically our diet consisted of canned food, which was kept in a cupboard under the sink. And, you know, it was all you could eat, SpaghettiOs, but it was always processed. And that was my diet, and that's not at all the way that I cook or eat today. Happily, and I'm grateful to Michael Pollan for helping the world see and understand and articulating so beautifully the situation that we're in today and helping us cook more good food at home.
Thank you very much.
You know, a lot of us in America don't cook the way our parents do, not just because maybe our parents were using processed food, but just that our food culture in this country is changing every generation dramatically. I mean, my mother doesn't cook the way she cooked when I was growing up. It's not like Italy or France where, you know, you learn these traditions and you internalize them and you keep reproducing them. We don't have deep food traditions, so therefore we're blown this way and that by either new ingredients or fashions. And, you know, it's a good thing in that there's a lot of novelty and people are learning new things all the time. It's a bad thing in that it's not like you can learn those 10 recipes from your parents and then have it covered.
One concept in your book is the interaction between food and culture.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you mean culture more than climate or geography, which, of course, determine what foods were available in any given place for much of human history.
Well, culture is very interesting to observe in food, and it begins in when you first start sautéing. Are you making a mirepoix? Are you making an Asian mirepoix? You know, most dishes cooked in pots begin with a chop of onions, and then it changes. It could be ginger and garlic. It could be if it's French, it could be carrots and celery. You know, if it's Spanish, it's a little different. These bases. Actually, we don't even realize it, but those are the kind of flavor signatures of those different cultures. And that has to do with what grew in those places very often. And onions happen to grow just about anywhere. So there are these flavor principles undergirding the great culinary traditions. And once you can master those, and master is a big word, it's not that hard, you basically can cook in that idiom.
Allie and Chelsea, you're on WNYC with Michael Pollan. Hi, Allie.
Hi, you guys. Good morning. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and I grew up in the 50s. And one thing I remember from my mother's kitchen is Trim Diet Cola. I remember the emphasis on dieting. I remember cottage cheese and Melba toast and a lot of meat. So I'm at home in my kitchen right now in Chelsea, and I'm looking at my cupboards, and I have dry garbanzo beans, quinoa, kidney beans, red lentils, little yellow lentils, dried shiitake. I do have something in a can. I have coconut milk, lots of spices, a fruit sweetened jam, sunflower seeds. Let's open the fridge. almond butter. I did not see anything other than maybe Jiffy or Skippy peanut butter growing up. I see some pesto I made, cashews, some collards, some kale.
Oh, there's so many possibilities here.
Yeah.
And you're just showing off.
I'm showing off, yes. I actually cook for people and deliver, but I eat this way too. And I also am involved in CSAs. So 6 months out of the year, I have to basically push my fridge door closed because of all the veggies. So that's a big difference.
And for people who don't know CSAs, that's the community supported agriculture where people in the city get linked up with people at relatively local farms.
And they get a weekly box of produce, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's daunting very often. I mean, it's wonderful because you're forced to figure out what do you do with a rutabaga. And you often get an oversupply because you're a partner with the farmer. And if he's got too much of something, you do too.
Allie, thank you for a wonderful call. But on that point, are you more of a locavore or an organivore? That is, do you place a higher priority, as some people do, on eating things that are locally grown for the low environmental impact of not having to transport things so much? Or do you lean more toward the really purely grown food, and if it's trucked from California or Chile, that's fine?
Yeah, I'm more of a locavore. I think organic food that's flown in from Chile is not organic in any meaningful sense of the word. I mean, it has a tremendous carbon footprint. Organic's important. It's probably the most reliable label you can find in the supermarket. It's actually audited. There's not a lot of fraud, and there's so much bull, you know, in the supermarket with health claims. So you can trust organic. But those rules were designed at a certain moment in time, and they reflected what environmental awareness was at that time, which did not include climate change. And so the carbon footprint of the food is not really considered. The fact that organic farms have to till more than conventional farms, and every time you till, you release carbon into the soil, carbon into the atmosphere. And, you know, yeah, the long-distance transportation is an issue. I live in California, though, so it's kind of easy for me to say, you know, because we can be, our farmers markets are open 50 weeks of the year. They only close because of Christmas and New Year's, and they're full of things. It's not just kale in January and February.
I will say that my local farmers market in Upper Manhattan is open 52 Saturdays a year.
No kidding.
Yeah,
that's progress.
New
when I lived in Manhattan,
new development in the last few years that it stays open all
that's
year.
That's great. Well, I think we're going to move to four-season farmers markets, covered structures the way they have in Europe. I mean, I just have a dream of these sprouting all over our cities.
So it's interesting that the calls we've taken so far are kind of the opposite of what I thought we would get, that people would talk about the purity of their parents' kitchen, and now they take all these shortcuts with modern conveniences and convenience foods. Instead, we're hearing about their parents using the packaged foods.
Well, the 60s was kind of a high watermark
for that,
for processed food. And the industry has been trying to force their way into our kitchens for a very long time and triumphed in the 60s and 70s.
So when we come back from a break, I want to ask you if you think you and other people who've been writing along similar lines have actually made a difference and things are starting now to go in the right direction, despite the efforts of agribusiness and the other food production companies. So we continue with Michael Pollan. His book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation, is out in paperback. We'll take more of your calls for Michael Pollan on either of those two tracks. How is your kitchen or your cooking different from your mother's? And anything you always wanted to ask Michael Pollan, but he wasn't around your kitchen table to do so. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. More with Michael Pollan coming up. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Michael Pollan, whose book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation, is just out in paperback. And by the way, Michael will be doing an event at the 92nd Street Y tonight. That's 8 o'clock tonight at the 92nd Street Y. Michael, we'll go back to the many phone callers who want to talk to you. We invited people to either talk about the difference between their own cooking and their parents' cooking, or just anything you want to ask Michael Pollan, because you've read his books and you never had him around to ask. But I just want to ask you one thing before we go back to phones. The themes in the book, you have the four recipes pegged to the four elements of earth, air, fire, and water. Is that just a literary device, or are you getting at something more connected than that?
No, it's I was surprised to learn when I tried to break cooking down, these transformations we call cooking, down into types to make sections from my book, that it really corresponded nicely to the classical elements. So cooking with fire is the first and the oldest. It goes back 2 million years. It really was the signal evolutionary event that changed us as a species. The reason we're human is because we discovered cooked food and got that kind of When you cook food, it gives you more calories, more energy, and that is why our brains got big and our guts shrank. That's why we're different than the apes. We're the cooking animal. And then I looked at water, which is cooking in pots, and that comes along only about 10,000 years ago with the birth of agriculture and the development of fired clay pottery. And cooking in pots was another great advance because it allowed you to combine vegetables, combine flavors, create sauce, have no waste. You know, when you're cooking over fire, you lose a lot of nutrition as the fat drips. When you cooked in pots, you also could keep people alive longer because people without teeth, you could still feed them. Before that, you couldn't. Oh. And it allowed you to wean children earlier because you could make gruels and soups and things like that. And then air was baking, which was a huge development, happened 6,000 years ago. And then earth is fermentation. So there's a little bit of a literary conceit in calling air baking, but I didn't think I was stretching too far. And there are some other transformations. I don't talk about frying, for example. That's an important one, or you could argue that's liquid also.
Your next book. David in Rockaway, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a sustaining member, by the way.
Thank you.
I am so honored to be able to talk with Michael. I finished reading Cooked a couple of weeks ago. My brother, who may be listening, is probably sick of hearing me describe what a great book it was. I just wanted to share with Michael that I recently put into action the roast pork recipe, but it's not really a recipe. It's more a set of guidance. Mm-hmm. I come from Puerto Rican heritage. And so I'm used to roast pork, pernil. And
barbecue begins in the Caribbean, actually. Yeah.
There we have it. So I thought I would take some of Michael's advice on just the basics of time and low heat. I differed. I used some of the flavorings that I was more familiar with as far as garlic. But I did salt the meat ahead of time. So just thanks a lot, Michael, for opening up a different way of cooking for me.
All right.
And if I could ask a question, you know, what's next? Where do you go next as an author? Because I think you're a fantastic author, let alone all the cooking stuff.
Where do you go next?
Oh, thanks. I haven't decided. At the moment, I'm working on a piece. I'm interested in things we ingest that affect our mind more than our bodies. And so I'm working on a piece on the science of psychedelics at the moment. Which is proving to be a fascinating topic.
Experimenting on yourself?
No, I'm not doing participatory journalism on this one quite yet.
Lex in Whippany, New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lex.
Hi, how are you two doing today?
Okay, thank you.
Pretty good, thanks.
Thank you for taking my call. I'll make it quick. So I'm kind of a foil of myself. I grew up in the 90s. I'm only 23. I love your show, Brian.
Thank you.
But I'm actually sitting outside of the Cadbury Adams parking lot because I design gum for a living, and I actually used to design for Nabisco. But I'm a local bore, so I had a CSA in college. I eat mostly a veggie diet, the whole nine, so I'm a foil of myself. But I'm mostly calling in to hear Mr. Pollan's remarks on local agriculture and food access. So when I was in college, I did my thesis on geriatric food access in the Pioneer Valley. So food is a right, but we really look at it as a privilege. Like, most people don't have access to fruits and vegetables. And I love your remarks, Mr. Pollan, but what are your thoughts on, you know, really bringing better food to people that need it the most?
I think you raise a very important issue. We're in danger of having a two-food culture country, where there are people who can afford local food and organic food, and there are people who are stuck eating processed food. I do think a couple things about that cooking is a great equalizer. Cooking is available to all of us. And if you can cook, you can eat high-quality food because you can put more money into the quality of ingredients rather than having someone else process it. Yes, you have to invest more time, but it equalizes access to good food. And, you know, eating healthy does not mean eating organic or necessarily eating local. I mean, there is lots of, you know, I buy frozen vegetables all the time. And even if they're not organic, they're healthy food. And so we shouldn't confuse this idea of sustainable agriculture that access to that is is an absolute necessity to have a healthy diet. Eating cooked food of any kind is going to be healthier than what a lot of people are eating. That said, we need to democratize access to especially produce, fresh produce. And right now we subsidize the building blocks of fast food. We subsidize corn and soy and rice and wheat and cotton. We don't subsidize vegetables. And there's no reason we couldn't do that.
And Lex, thank you very much. Lex, who works at Cadbury, designing gum, she said, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I have not seen that at my local farmer's market yet, locally grown gum.
Gum. No, that's the next. I think that's a frontier we haven't crossed yet. Sure. But, you know, I always ask people who work at processed food companies, do you eat the food you make? And you talk to the executives at the big companies, no, they don't. They're also locavores and they eat organic.
John on Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hi. How are you guys doing?
Good, great. Good, we've got about a minute left, so sorry, but right to
make, okay, I just want to make a quick point that I feel that part of it is culturally how you grow up. I grew up, I'm black, but I grew up in sort of a middle to lower middle class neighborhood with other Italians and people of other ethnicities, and almost everybody had gardens in their backyard. We grew up on Staten Island, so there was never that disconnect between what was being grown and what you were cooking. And in fact, I got mad when vegetables and things like that started going up in the supermarkets when the prices went, you know, through the roof, just to have the stuff we used to basically grow. So I was wondering if you feel that.
Yeah, you make a really important point. The most democratic access to fresh fruits and vegetables, organic fresh fruits and vegetables, is if you grow it yourself. And anyone who has a little bit of land can do that. And it is. And if you grow food yourself, you will cook it. These things follow.
Of course, that's the best tasting food.
John, thank you very
much.
I'm
with you.
Michael Pollan, his latest book is Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation, now out in paperback. And again, he's doing an event at the 92nd Street Y tonight at 8 o'clock. Is that going to be just you on stage? Is somebody interviewing you?
No, it's just me on stage, talking, reading some excerpts, taking a lot of questions.
All right, so there you go, 92nd Street Y tonight. Michael Pollan, always such a pleasure, and you have so many fans in our audience, so keep coming back, okay?
Thank you, Brian.
And coming up on the Leonard Lopate Show, right after the news, they have Glenn Greenwald, who's got his book about Edward Snowden just out. Glenn Greenwald with Leonard after the latest news. Let's see, what else do they have today? Evan Osnos, the New Yorker's correspondent in China, talks with Leonard about the profound political, economic, and cultural upheaval that he's seen in that country. So Evan Osnos and Glenn Greenwald with Leonard after the latest news. Brian Lehrer, talk to you tomorrow on WNYC.